You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
Tonight's event, We Are Our Own Now, is the first in a series of three events we're doing this month to inaugurate our newest issue called Bonitas, which explores contemporary meditations on mortality, as well as the delights, delusions, and pressures of fleshly existence. I'm really excited to introduce Francis Bodomo and Nimwali Serpell, who will be presenting their work tonight. Nimwali Serpell is a writer and associate professor at UC Berkeley. Her first book of literary criticism, Seven Modes of Uncertainty, was published by Harvard University Press in 2014, and her first novel is coming out in 2018. Frances is a Ghanaian writer and director. She grew up in Ghana, Norway, California, and Hong Kong, and before she moved to New York to study film at Columbia and NYU. And her films, The Afronauts and Boneshaker, both premiered at Sundance and went on to screen at numerous other festivals. So we'll begin tonight with a reading from Nimwali of her short story, Triptych, Texas Pool Party, which will be published online by Triple Canopy in the coming weeks. It's so great to have Nimwali be able to be here, because I first commissioned her piece almost a year ago, so, and it remains like as timely and urgent as ever. And after we hear from Nimwali Reed, we'll be screening Francis's short film, Everybody Dies, which is in the format of a game show starring the Grim Reaper, who teaches black children about death. And after all of that, we'll be gathering together to talk about Nimwali and Francis's work, which I encourage you all to participate in. So thanks again, and without further ado, Nimwali.
Hello. Thanks for being here. Thanks, Emily, for commissioning the piece, and thanks, Francis, for joining us with your amazing film. So the story is in three parts. I'll read the first two. The third part is entitled What Was Said, and it's a transcript of all the words spoken in the video clip of the incident on which the story is based. In lieu of reading that transcript, in which shouts, questions, and declarations are run together without attribution and with little punctuation, we will instead play the audio track of the clip over a black screen. That footage is raw and violent and may be upsetting to some of you, just as a warning. No one will take offense if you choose not to listen. Triptych, Texas Pool Party. 1. Summertime. Easy does it, do it easy. The bell rings, school's out, it's summertime. The weather's fine. The summer's a natural aphrodisiac. The guys are out hunting, the ladies are wearing less, checking out the fellas, deciding who's next. The kids are flirting too. The boys messing around with the girls playing double dutch, girls giggling like their bodies are full of bubbles. Even old folks are dancing, reminiscing on bliss, talking about the growing up days, the first one they kissed. The smell of the barbecue, the tilt of the sun, can spark a flash from the past, just like that. Yeah, you already know. Meat grilling, DJ spinning, it's a birthday cookout at the park across from Tatiana's spot in McKinney. Everybody roll up looking real fine, fresh from the barbershop, fly from the beauty shop. Bright t-shirts, jeans dark and crisp, sneak so white they sneak squeak on your eyes. Dudes standing around still as ice, girls shaking all over, moving to the music, tossing their braids, talking all coy over their shoulders. I'm gonna make you tremble. I want to get you shook. The heat rises up, it sings against the skin. Clothes fall off, swimsuits blossoming from beneath in colors as neon and elaborate as the sunset to come. We dance and we dance. All of this beauty, all of this rolling, dipping brown flesh, like desert dunes in the shadow or desert dunes in the sun. When we say dime or honey, we mean silver and gold because summer is conspiring to make everything glint like coin. Sunlight adorns our lip-glossed lips, our bare shoulders and brows. We shine. You can see tracks glisten in the thick of that weave. You can see sweat mingle with the Vaseline on those edges. Flashy phones in our hands like accessories or weapons. Chains bright enough to dazzle. Belt buckles and rings, bottles sitting in crushed ice like broken glass. Bottles and bottles, ice on ice. You want to splash? Want to spark up? Snip fits flame lit, damn, I'd hit that. I want to kiss you on your collarbone. Yeah, he kind of cute. I want you inside of me. The bass line deepens, hips drop and pop and circle. The different kinds of smoke twine their patterns in the slanting light. Barbecue and weed and cigarettes and vape. A feeling swarms in. No homework for the foreseeable future. Boys start saying shit just to get in trouble. Pussy tight as OJ's glove. Spilling bubbly like Mike Brown's blood. We trample the grass. We lose our pretty things. We yell across the street to each other. We step up, step off, we step. Step. Girls relent in waves. This one backs it up on that one sleepy-eyed nigga, and her girls follow suit, their little dance circle expanding, then breaking up like ripples in the water. Speaking of water, y'all gonna swim? Yeah, let's go in. Who got the pool pass? Where Tatiana at? Where's KC? Y'all seen Ariana? Aw, nah, who the hell is this dude? Mall cop, security guard. What you mean we can't be here? Yes, we can be here. We're with Tatiana Rhodes. She lives here in this apartment complex. We just want to get inside to the pool area. She invited us. We got passes. You can't get to just kick us out, man. Nah, that's some bullshit. We live here. We live here. We live here. This ain't alcohol, man. It's just coke. But then this one girl trips kind of sloppy, and we laugh out loud with kindness in our hearts. Yo, that kid jumped the gate. For real? Boost me up. Boost me up. Security guard's losing his shit, making up rules just to keep us out. But Tatiana's up in here with us now, and she lives here, so we cool. Our bodies in and out of the pool, hanging on the edge, dangling over. The chlorine air, the blue sky above almost shamed by the blue of the pool. There's a scrawny dog running around barking at us. Fucking racist dog. We laugh and we laugh. There's a lot of us in the water because it's hot as hell, and the pool's as cool as silver on the eye. Somebody looks down at their feet and says, whoa, what the fuck is that? All eyes drop and somebody says, yo, is that blood? Boys jump back like, oh, shit. Girls scream a little and check their crotches on the sly. It's all over the place, a splatter of red droplets on the concrete, darker than the splashes of pool water, and there's a chaos of wonder and denial until somebody realizes it's that goddamn racist dog bit his own tongue. Frowning white ladies by the pool shaking their heads at us. Country-ass dudes with bellies hanging over their shorts with that look in their eye. We catch snatches of words from their conversations. Allowed, refusing, leave, drugs, uncomfortable. That scrawny-ass dog still tripping and barking. One lady in a green swimsuit with a frilly skirt looking like a snake in a tutu. Well, a snake that just ate up a rack of barbecue. She starts talking shit, talking about you better get used to the bars on that gate you jump because that's all you're ever going to see. The man with her, this diabetes-ass dude with chin pubes, laughs like, ha, ha, ha. Tatiana's like, don't mind her, she don't even live here. But the big dude says, I do, and she's with me. Yeah, well, we got passes too. Splish, splash. We brush off the platinum drops jeweling our skin. But Grace ain't having it. Grace is all, that's not cool, you can't talk to kids like that. Well, Grace can say that because Grace is white, she's one of them. They talk back, but they're talking right past Grace, talking around her, talking to us, talking about little black fuckers, that's why you live in Section 8 houses. Ha, ha, ha. So now Grace straight goes off. Assholes, she says. Hateful, she says. Racists. All us boys are low-key falling back, hands to grinning lips. Oh, shit, y'all hear what Grace said? And all us girls are low-key swiveling up behind Grace, hands on our hips, saying without saying, and what? And this other white lady, fat like her friend, She tells Grace all to the side, like giving her some womanly advice and shit. Don't talk to adults like that. You should do better with your life. Find a nice path for yourself. But to us, she says, go back to Section 8. And Tatiana, who lives here, says, excuse me? And this woman, who doesn't, slaps Tatiana in her face. And then they're entwined like lovers, fingers in each other's hair. There is death here. Don't you know? There is death everywhere. You already know. And the knowing is glitter in your hands. 5-0, 5-0, but not quite yet. So we are slow in our scatter before the sirens come. We linger. We are not ready to give up our joy. Joy is not being beaten. Joy is not being despised. Joy is not seeing that look in their eye. Joy is saying, those kicks are tight, that rope is dope. Joy is falling into a brown depth of skin, the color of most people's skin. Joy is laughing with the love of a thing that sparkles. We enjoy our loud laughter, we who are not being beaten. Not being beaten is the most perfect feeling. Not being beaten can become the secret goal of an entire life. So long as we aren't being beaten, our animal laughter can be as rowdy as joy is rowdy. I love your chain. I love those kicks. It's good to be here. We don't owe you shit. We own this shit. We once owned, whose flesh once belonged. We are our own now. And it's good to own, good to own, good to own. Two, Perseus. The earth, against its will, has spawned a multiplicitous serpent, a terror to men, sprawling thick and glistening across mountains and valleys and plains. It is one beast, a super predator, but it is made up of a host of dangerous criminals. I and my fellow officers of the law, we destroy the monster continually with 1,000, 1,000,000 bullets. This gear fits my broad shoulders. My aim is sure. I fire often. My bullets slay the bloated creature that spreads its vast coils across so many acres of this great land. But it always comes back to life despite our valiant efforts. Even as I, in triumph, make my way home with my rustling gear, carrying the slain creature in my arms, drops of blood from my quarry fall to the ground. The spattered earth gives them life anew, like smooth-bodied snakes sprouting from the blood that I spill, and so this land swarms still with deadly men. I am a former highway patrol trooper, a U.S. Navy military police veteran, and a corporal. I have in-depth training in impact weapon deployment and in expandable baton firearms, electronic devices, positive assertive control tactics, dynamic threat response, handcuffing, joint locks, pressure point compliance, and armed and unarmed self-defense. I am a master of several disciplines of martial arts, including combat and ground fighting. I have a strong working knowledge of human behavior, indicators of deception, criminal behavior, situational awareness, and experience in the use of all levels of force. I have received 8 hours of culture diversity training and have taken racial profiling courses. Training videos spool across my YouTube channel, titles such as Man Attacks Baltimore Police Officer, and Man Sucker Punches Cop Gets Kicked in the Face, and Man with Gun Approaching Police Car, and Martial Arts Wrist Locks, and Traffic Stop Gone Wrong, and Two Cops in Robbery Live and Caught on Tape, and Self-Defense Roll and Strike Drill. When called to duty, you must be crafty and tactical, especially in a place like McKinney, Texas. Around here, everyone says hello and stops to chat. It is a truly hometown feeling. A cul-de-sac, a labyrinth of small roads. Here, summer arrives with sunlight, calm breeze, and bounty. Children and their guardians feasting and festivaling, amusing themselves by the pool. But if a dark storm swoops in and makes this peaceful hamlet witness to an orgy of dissipation, if a noisy mob should crowd in, then this nice neighborhood is transformed to tumult, like a quiet sea that the winds in fury rouse to raging waves. The dispatch call comes in around sunset. Disorderly conduct, underage drug and alcohol use, altercation between black female and middle-aged white female. Through solitudes remote and trackless, over smooth roads and fine neighborhoods, I reach the land where the dread beast has erupted. I leap from my keening chariot with its wheeling lights, the colors of our flag. I see them everywhere, in the grass, by the road, all the moving shapes, a criminal chaos, a disorder of conduct. I give chase, my men beside me. Light flashes from me, reflecting off the bright shield pinned to my breast. I spring from the ground and soar, but on unfamiliar terrain, I am more flat-footed than fleet. I stumble on the devious ground, a pebble or a root, and fly forward, but I know my training. I tuck and roll like a great boulder, and I am up and at chase once more. My men are scattered to the winds. I am besieged. On all sides, suspects swarm to assail me, to wage against me an unequal war, to rob me of all I have won by honor and just deserts. Lambs flee from wolves and hinds from lions and the fluttering doves from eagles. Every creature flees its foes, but I do not turn heel. Love of man, of country, of blind and righteous justice, love spurs me to reverse the pursuit. I dart one way, then the other, corralling them. You there, you run too fast, check your swift flight. I am no thug, I am no pig, I am no unkempt hick or prick. I am lord of the law, a son of this great nation. This is the police I order you to stop, to go, stop, now go. I alone am your traffic light. By me are future, past, and present decided. Sure are my bullets, and all men call me healer. You don't take off running when the cops get here. Get on the fucking ground. One struts before me, blaring as if her lips are pressed to a horn, flipping her hair and running her mouth. She is the blatant embodiment of all that refuses me. She is bare as a nymph in her swimsuit, but there be demons in her. The monster rises up in her. Her limbs become coils, her tongue bulges forth and forks. Just as an eagle spies in an empty field, a snake sunning itself and strikes it from the rear, securing with eager claws the writhing scaly neck, lest the serpent turn with its deadly fangs, thus do I, swooping headlong through the void, attack her from behind. As she shrieks, I sink my grip deeper into her shoulder. Wounded sorely, she rears upright, high in the air, bucking in her frenzy, then dives down. I duck and weave, eluding her snapping mouth, and I strike at the parts exposed, my crescent grip binding her limbs, holding them down on the ground. I put her on her knees. The other suspects surround me now, baying at me, their mouths open. Thick and fast as hail, their insults and backtalk fly at me, no matter that I give them orders to stay, go, stay. I push them back. I feel too closing upon me, and I reckon that my valor cannot vie with the weight of their numbers, so I brandish my gun like a gorgon's head, a weapon to make them freeze. But they do not halt. They shout and bolt. My loyal men stay me by the elbows and encourage me to holster my weapon. Truly, I do not need it. I will use my bare hands to finish this business. I turn back to the girl. She is calling like a child for her mother. And scarce has she made her plea when through her limbs a dragging languor spreads and she sits as if in a tantrum and sets her fist into her hand. She is still wailing, still resisting. Me, I, who am here to keep the peace, soaked with sweat, my gear so heavy I can barely lift myself, I seek a flat surface, there, some grass, and swiftly, once more, I plant her. Her snakes of hair, braided like whips, fling in my face. I trap them, a web beneath my palm. Her tender torso is wrapped in thin, smooth cloth the color of raw sun. Her slender arms are mere vines. I root her face down into the ground. I am on my knees now. I am kneeling on her. The kings of this hallowed land come to my aid, surveilling and standing guard, silently approving. But the beast is too manifold. It rearranges its many coils around us, its many eyes glinting, its many mouths opening and closing. And I see the slabs of gold and silver in its several hands, like currency to bargain with or tools to reckon with. And embedded in those shining slabs, I see tiny flashes, eyes emitting light, receiving it. Yes, I say, look upon my glory. Look all you want with your freezing eyes, the rolling ones in your monstrous heads and the metal ones in your monstrous hands. Look upon me. They exclaim with accusation. They call out my weapon, not comprehending that it is not my gun that has wrought this. It is my hands. I accuse them right back. I tell them to back off. I glare at the many-eyed Argus, many-headed Medusa, this mass monster. She is still mewling beneath me, but I will not cast my eyes down upon her. I will not open my ears to this girl. I will fill myself up with wax until all my openings are closed to her. The situation is under control. All men call me healer. I can still feel the tendons of her neck rippling under the bone of my knee. I can still feel under my other knee the bolts of vertebrae along her spine, which is like a chain that runs down her body and branches at her young pelvis. Oh, fragile bones, fragile quaking bones, bones, nerves, veins, all these splitted lines inside her body, linking her yet open mouth to the rounded heels of her yet naked feet. She seems small, but I know that she is legion. As I kneel there upon her, a strange serenity descends. The burn of my bravery swirls in my veins, an intoxicating drowse. The beast approaches and recedes in a blur. Time slows. Ticking minutes dilate to vastest centuries. Like the chill condensation that slithers from the roof of a cave, gathering at the very tip of an icicle that hovers above a pool of water as still as glass. Thus does time draw at once into a point and a swell. Thus does this moment brim still over a stillness. A breath of wind and the drop will drop, dispel the spell, and send out the circles of consequence. In the end, there will be no award pinned to my breast or hung from my neck, no ceremonious recounting of this tale at banquet or bar. My deeds will be sanctioned, but I will be suspended. And during my suspension, I will sit at home alone in front of a screen, trapped as Prometheus on his rock, Sisyphus on his hill. Gut churning, I will watch the YouTube of this story over and over, watch myself roll like a boulder over a girl, 15 years old, 15 years old, watch myself pinion her. I will hear her voice calling mother. And one day, as I sit there clicking refresh, I will realize, sudden as a bolt, that the condition of this story is an invisible eye, a white kid standing behind me, holding his phone up, tracking me, his little screen framing this fray. Part 3, What Was Said.
He has a flashlight.
God, I got damn. A flashlight, my nigga.
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit, bro.
Bam.
Do you see him?
Hey, let me go give it to him.
No, I want to give it to him.
No. Hey, let me give it to him.
No, I want to give it to him. Fuck you.
Hey, it was him.
She got like a blackout right now.
No, it wasn't his.
Well, he is here.
It was his.
Don't take off running when the cops get here. What's up, man? Oh, thank you.
It was some guy, one of these cops.
Okay, guys, I appreciate it.
None of them were involved.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
It was this guy's. It was that guy's.
Well, sir,
get on the ground.
Hold up, sir.
I told you to stay. Your ass is down on the ground.
The girl right there, running, she's one of the black bottoms and pink top.
In the ground.
Damn, bro, we're hooping.
Get
your ass out of here. Change back.
I didn't even do anything. I wasn't even in here.
Who is you? Georgie?
I'm just by him, man.
Yes.
Hey, come on, man.
What the heck?
Sir,
we just got here.
Sir, we just came for a birthday party. Please.
We'll figure it out in a minute.
Please, sir.
Sit down. Yo, Richard, what color was it?
It's navy blue.
I know where it is.
That's evading. So right now you're staying. Don't make me fucking run around here with 30 pounds of goddamn gear on the sun because you want to screw around out here. Y'all keep standing there and run your mouths. You're going to go too. Get out of here. I already told you. I don't care. Leave. You're leaving now. You're leaving now. You are leaving now. Leave. That way.
Don't talk shit.
Then get your ass gone.
Don't you talk to nobody.
Get right in your mouth.
Oh, my mother. Leave. Oh, my mother.
You know what? All right, I'm going. Yo, Jelfer, what the why is he acting so crazy?
Again.
I swear we came
I personally told you to get on the ground and stay, didn't I? And what did you do when I walked away? So you just did what everybody else did. And what everybody else did was illegal. You did it and you got caught. They didn't. Now you're sitting here paying for it.
We just came here for one
thing. I don't have a problem. That's not my problem. I asked y'all to sit. You became a part of the mob. You could have been the guys that were doing right. And you weren't, so now you're sitting here in trouble.
We can go get our friends.
You're gonna sit here until we get this figured out.
Hey guys.
Hello? Okay, great. So for our Vanitas issue, one of the things that we've been thinking a lot about is the sort of unprecedented speed and diversity with which we are now able to document our lives. Obviously, we talk a lot about selfies, and people love pointing to selfies as a sort of like evidence of our like collectively growing vanity. But there's something to be said about the sort of about popular documentation's accessibility and ubiquity in the context of an increasingly unequal and precarious world. Posterity sort of takes on like a different valence when the future is in no way guaranteed. There's a long history, of course, of popular documentation of police brutality, but it's only sort of in recent years that we've been able to share that kind of documentation pretty much instantaneously into millions of people. And so both of you, both of your works are sort of interested in the possibilities and limitations of popular documentation. So I wanted to start by asking you, Namwali, about the way in which you've incorporated documentary material into your story. So the third section, as Namwali mentioned, for her story is a transcript of the video, of the audio that we heard. And so for tonight's event, we chose to play the audio rather than read the transcript. You know, I was really struck listening to the audio by just how sort of like much noisier it is and like how visceral, and you get a sense of like the proximity of people to one another and like with the transcript, a lot of that noise is sort of stripped away, like a lot of that sort of like rawness and incoherence. So I was wondering why you chose to present this audio the way that you did in your story, framing it as part of a fictional story.
Yeah, it's clear that the first two parts of the story are very stylized. And I thought to go kind of cinema veritas or whatever in the last section would counteract that high stylization. But I wanted to include some kind of documentation of the incident that the story is based on to give a sense of its reality, so that this is not just something I kind of imagined out of thin air. And in thinking about presenting it as a transcript without punctuation and without that noise, I was thinking to a certain extent recently in our conversations about it that I think part of what I was trying to channel is another kind of documentation that we have now, which are court transcripts of people's testimony during these usually ineffective grand jury trials. This officer, for example, was not indicted. And I think the young woman who he assaulted is filing a civil suit. But I had analyzed the transcript of Darren Wilson's testimony in the case of Mike Brown in a course that I was teaching on black science fiction. And I was comparing the language that he used about Mike Brown to the way that Edgar Allan Poe uses certain kinds of very warped language in his early kind of proto-science fiction, and the kind of monstrosity being projected onto Mike Brown in that court transcript. So I had already treated a court transcript of an incident like this as fiction and my work as a professor, and so there was some kind of logical logic to that when I decided that the third tick of the triptych would be that that kind of documentation, not raw footage, but a kind of evidentiary, almost legalistic, this is what was actually said. Can you actually assign blame or indict someone based on the words that were spoken?
Yeah, that makes me think, you know, that's really interesting because in one way, by you know, sort of just changing the context of this text, you're drawing attention to all the ways in which evidence leaves out so much, but also like the like how much we read into evidence. Like when I read the third section, it's not like I'm just like I'm imagining their voices into these sort of decontextualized statements. And that really makes me think to like about the extent to which sort of like the language of legal standards for like police deployment of force just like depends on, you know, the sort of like metric of reasonableness. Like it's all about sort of like officers can use force if they reasonably believe that, you know, the person they're confronting presents a serious physical threat. And so that immediately privileges the point of view of the officer, of his sort of subjective assessment of what's going on in that moment of the encounter. And I'm wondering if, like, that's something you were thinking about when you chose to, you know, write the first section from the first person plural, but the second section from the point of view of the officer, like to give him all that like space in the story.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the amount of real estate that he takes up in the story. And I have found in at least three of my stories that are set in the States, I'm from Zambia, so I also write stories that are set in my home country, but at least three of the stories set in the States, I take on the perspective of white Americans, and it's a kind of internal critique, it's kind of a satire. And in this case, I was obviously trying to do the same thing by using this epic language and trying to understand what might motivate a faith in valor and valiance, which gets kind of touted so often in defenses of the police. But I also didn't want to go into the perspective of the young woman because I wanted to push against a particular trope of victim speak. And I didn't want to present yet another almost like bordering on pornographic depiction of this girl being assaulted. I mean, she's almost naked, and that's one of the reasons I didn't want us to show the video, because it just recapitulates a very particular image of the black female body. And so what I wanted with the black kids' voices in the first part was to register joy and to register the premise of these kids getting together in the first place, and so that the last words that you have from them are a kind of testament to the power of a certain kind of self-ownership and self-possession. That kind of vanitas, like the kind of vanity of bling, right, culture, but at the same time to know that that's in vain, right, that other kind of vanitas, because there's death present even in the midst of that joy.
So in a similar vein, Frances, you know, when I first watched your film, I was really interested in the choice to have the Grim Reaper be portrayed by a black woman. Rather, I feel like the more obvious choice might be to have the Reaper be a white man. And I mean, of course, as we see in the film, she's less sort of like an active or willing participant than sort of, she's like trapped. She's this sort of unwilling like vessel. Yeah, could you say more about Ripa's role within the show or in relation to the audience?
I guess when I was making this film, I was in the headspace of we were having these narratives happening again and again. It wasn't just an event, it was this continuous event. And I think one of the biggest like pushes to make a film like this was to question the sort of emotional logic we had around the police brutality events that were happening, especially as they were happening continuously. And I think that to have a white male Grim Reaper would make it an easier evil. And also this film is part of a wider project. It's called Collective Unconscious. It's five filmmakers adapting each other's dreams. So I received the dream prompt that was very not like this at all. It was very dreamy. I think what I really wanted to explore, because what came to me from the dream statement I received with that was that there was this really tender humanity or tender person within an uncaring world. And I think with Ripo, what we get to explore in the film is this being in between the sort of high happy affect and the high sort of tragic affect, and how she's sort of forced to keep it together because that's just her fate. She can't kill herself. She's always going to be here, and how everything about her is cracking at the seams. Everything about her is like quivering, shivering, and just, you know, trying to keep it together. And I thought that once we started to explore the Grim Reaper as that, it brought this sort of newer emotional logic that we wanted to explore, which is away from, oh, this thing is going to happen and we're going to give it this huge amount of sadness because it's so singular, and then it's going to go away. No, it was more that these things, you know, it's like we're giving it this sadness and it's happening again. We're giving it this sadness, it's happening again. It becomes weariness, it becomes exhaustion, it becomes something different than reasonableness or logic, something that there's good, there's bad, and there's this horrible thing that happened that we can fix. it just became something that was more quivering, I guess, and having Ripa be a black woman and be this person that had this very like shifty, switching role in this, explored more of that than sort of an easier emotional space.
It seems like both of you are sort of interested in like intervening in the cycles of production and consumption of these kinds of videos, because there's a sense in which video footage doesn't archive only like what it has recorded, but also like the sort of like affective response that like spectacular violence demands. And I wanted to ask you both like a sort of more general question about what you think like fiction affords as an archive, if you would call it that, that more straightforward documentary does not.
From like a film perspective, it's very hard to distinguish like the doc form from the fictional form, because I think there's a history, of course, of seeing the documented form as truth, as realness, and there's a long history of like films and fictional films that glorify that, like Fritz Lang's Fury, where it's like at the end the video footage saves the day in the court case, you know. But I think that the videos we get now, the sort of speed of the videos we get now, and the sort of inability of those videos to create indictments is shifting. Like there's still a gaze, right? And there's still power, and there's still power that can enact what it wants to or needs to enact, regardless of what truth is. So I don't know if we lose this sort of like truth, this logic, this reason, then what then does distinguish documentary from fiction? Becomes my question. It's a really roundabout way.
It's in a lot of ways, I think fiction has to fail. It cannot provide the documentary evidence that would get someone indicted. My story wouldn't be submitted in a court case, right? And to that extent, it would be a political non-starter. I think, and in that sense, I think we need the documentary form. We need the actual evidence. We need people to hold their phones up. And I think it's key. And it's incredible to the interview that they did with the kid who filmed this, who just stood there. And like at no point did any of the cops try to make him sit down or put his hands behind his back. And that is the condition for us having that footage at all. So I think it's really important to have that documentary and image and evidence. But for me, I wanted to write the story because when I saw the footage of this, And, you know, when you see the footage of people actually being shot and killed, it's incredibly exhausting, and this kind of endless mourning is something that has really, I think since doing that lecture on Mike Brown has, like, it's registered to me how much it affects me, my psychic space. And I'm not even an American citizen, but living here, that it takes a toll. But watching this video of this little girl, there was a very particular moment that I wanted to capture, and I felt like I needed, in order to capture all of the elements that produced that moment for me in watching it, I needed to write about the kids, and I needed to write in this way. And it's that moment in part two where time slows, and it's the moment when I was watching the video where I was like, he's still kneeling on her. Like, it was like 2 minutes in and he was still kneeling on her, and I just couldn't fathom that, and I needed some way to grapple with what could lead a man of that size and weight to kneel on this girl for so long. And the thought that kept striking me was like, I don't think that in this moment she is human to him. And I needed a way to grapple with that, I don't know, psychological or spiritual, or that truth that I needed fiction to get to that, to explain that to myself. So I think that was the use of it for me. In some ways, it was like my own catharsis or something. I hope it's like useful to you guys too to hear it. But that's why I wrote the story.
Yeah. It sounds like there was a kind of like excess and also like ongoingness that like the narrative of like scandal or like spectacular violence can't really account for or like hold. I'm interested in sort of the ways you both use structure to like generate new affective responses. I'd love to hear you both say more about all the other kinds of like earlier we talked about stripping away noise, but like the way in which you add in various kinds of language, like language from songs, language from myth, Francis, in your film, you've chosen to present the show as this sort of like 1970s like public access show rather than a more familiar contemporary format. And I'm wondering what do those sorts of experiments in genre do for you or like produce in terms of like encounter?
I think the way you phrased the question is it speaks exactly to what I was trying to do. I think sometimes when people do a triptych or they have a multiple part piece of fiction, it's in order to offer a kind of like Rashomon structure that produces uncertainty about what actually took place. And in some ways that structure is very indebted to court cases. Like the earliest version of that multiple structure was a poem about a court case by Browning called, I think, The Ring in the Book. And so, but that's not what I was doing in this case. I wasn't trying to present a he said, she said. And I think the nature of the distinction between the voices and, as you said, the perspectives should indicate that. And nor was I trying to do like a synthesis where I had like thesis, antithesis, and then the last triptych is like everybody together. Rather, I was thinking more about movements in music, and to try and build a certain kind of emotional resonance, or as you said, affective response. So song was really important to part one. There's lines in there from Fresh Prince. There's lines in there from there were more lines before, but a few lines from Summertime, the jazz standard. And Perseus came to me because I really, it really struck me that I wanted the story of Perseus and the Medusa, because there's the monstrosity and the idea of a warrior. And I went to Ovid as a source because I don't know, I really wanted to capture the high epic tone, but in order to have the kind of animalistic language, Ovid seemed a better choice for me than some other sources of that myth. And I wanted, again, there to be this kind of musicality that that resonated across the three to give it a certain kind of tone.
For me, I think the public access 70s game show afforded many things, but the two that come to mind now are that to have it in the 70s gave it this sense of, added to the wariness. In terms of, as you mentioned, documentation that's been happening for a while, it's happening faster now, but it's been happening. But also, the film is anachronistic because she makes reference to the Eric Garner case and some things now too. So just the sense that like there was this loop of just time was this thing, like in terms of it happening again and again, and get this ongoingness, this lack of like sort of linear logic to it. So that's what the 70s part of it did. And then the game show part of it was to sort of take on this like great American superstructure that had the very business need to keep its show going regardless of whatever should happen. Pippa might break down and it's like, you know, what is it? We're having technical difficulties and we're back. And it's just sort of like the TV host voice, no matter what is happening, would be this like very cheerful, canned thing, and sort of using that like that juxtaposition of this system, this structure that like always fed itself and always kept itself visibly concrete and together, no matter what was happening within it, afforded a lot of like experiments with affect. Because I said that I had started this thing being sort of saddened by how we popularly, or let's say on social media, discuss these events. I still had a lot of questions. I didn't have the answers as to how we should. And to take this sort of structure that wasn't going to change and like push events into it created this moments of what I call ickiness. like it was sort of like to have the laughter with the sadness and then just put it together in different formulations and see how it felt and know that it felt like what was happening, but not know necessarily why was very important in the process of putting this film together.
All right, well, I could ask questions all day, but if you guys have questions for each other, and if people in the audience also want to start asking questions if you have them.
Well, I was going to say one of the things that I noticed on this, like in putting the two together so explicitly, was this like eternal return feeling, which comes out in the structure of what you did formally, and I think really only comes out in my piece in the sense that like by going back to a classical version of masculinity, I'm suggesting it's always been there and justifying a certain kind of violence, but also the moment where he watches his own, the YouTube of the incident, which we have evidence that he did. He had a YouTube channel, this police officer, that was taken down, but there was a screenshot of it, and the videos that had been watched most recently, some of which I listed, a lot of which are about cops being attacked by suspects, but also like wrist locks and stuff, and like learning how to tuck and roll and stuff. But there's also like the video of him doing this was the last video on there before he shut down his YouTube account. And there, the weirdness for me of that, of someone participating in the spectatorship of their own act and not being able to tell whether he's watching that out of, and in my version of the story, he's watching it and there's a kind of guilt that's there. Like there's a kind of realization that she's 15 and seeing himself do that would make him realize that. But like, it's very possible that it was like a weird, like like it was pleasurable for him to see himself in these positions of, in this position of power, right? So it's this very odd kind of self-fulfilling and like endlessly cycling thing that's built into the medium of recording.
Yeah, but I just mentioning the sort of like mythic epicness that he was punching up to, I think that what's so effective about that section of the piece is that he hasn't reached it. He's the one calling himself healer of all, and like he's the one that's like sort of using this language on himself, but it's sort of like if you've seen the video, and once you hear the video too, it just doesn't feel as godly at all, you know what I mean? Yeah. He doesn't have control of anyone. I'm not sure if it's him specifically speaking in the video, but it's the police officer is sort of like, I told you to do that and you didn't do that, and now that's why this is happening. And so it's sort of this distance between this image he wants from himself and what he is, and that eternal like reach for that is what kind of creates the situation, or like these acts that sitting on her and kneeling on her and like
is like
elongating
necessary.
That moment of glory.
Do we have any questions? Yeah.
First, can you work for a second?
Thank you very much. The work is important. Very, very well done, and both of you deserve a lot of credit for the written word and the visuals.
Thank you.
I have to say that the conversation, to me, is dealing a lot with the artistic process, which is very important. But possibly people's lives are more important. And I feel we've gotten away from talking about that here. So I'm very curious. I recall seeing this initially when it happened on TV, of course. But the story soon died. And I'm curious, were any guns or verbal threats ever found to have occurred or be found when the police arrived?
No.
Okay.
No. So the incident that I describe in the party where a middle-aged white woman and a young black girl attacked each other. That happened, and that's what was called into the police. Right. But they attach each other physically. There's video footage of that as well. They it was just their hands, but there were no guns.
Right. So, obviously, the police overreacted.
Right.
That's kind of obvious. But I'm really looking for is some type of addressing of this situation, as opposed to sort of letting the police get away with this. I mean, at the beginning we were talking about the proliferation of digital imagery recording these types of incidents. Well, they haven't solved many problems, those images. And they've been around for, 15 or 20 years? So I think the artwork was very important, but I think those are bigger issues, especially to the majority of the population who have to deal with this oppression. So if anybody would like to take it from there.
I just... I think it's telling that you said, obviously, the police overreacted, and I think that's part of the reason why work like Namali's and like what we saw today is important. I think that when you say that it's not about the police's overreaction, it's about how the policemen are trained. Like, this is, they're trained for this to be the norm, escalation. It's all part of the training, right? The system is what we need to be talking about and punching up too. And then also with the police overreaction, this idea that the black body is this thing to be feared, I don't know if it, yeah, we had talked about this previously, but just sort of like the image of the black body, and as you were saying in your black science fiction class, just Darren Wilson talking about what, not who, but what Mike Brown was, and that eliciting overreaction, like this all comes from perceptions of black bodies that have nothing to do, or very little to do with reality, right? It's all perception, right? And it, yeah, I mean, that's...
I mean,
I'm sorry. What I thought of when I saw and heard of your work was Ta-Nehisi Coates' book. Uh-huh. And I thought, like, his work is a companion to yours, yours is a companion to his. And that's my, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I was actually going to cite Claudia Rankine, who has famously has this poem, which is, I think I might not get it right, but it's like black men are dying because the police can't police their imagination. Right. Is that what it is? Yeah. Because people can't police their imagination. And so, which is to say, like, you know, I'm not a legal scholar. I'm a creative writer and a professor, so I can't speak to whether body cameras or banning guns or, you know, better indictments or like not having grand juries or not making the case for police so strong in those grand juries that indictments don't happen. Like, those are things that obviously I can think about and support as a citizen. But as an artist, I think trying to access what motivates a human being to act a certain way, whether or not the law prevents it or encourages it, is from, you know, and to try and understand what is behind the feeling of justification behind an act of violence like that. And some of that is the objectifying of the black body, which I try to capture. And some of that is the feeling of heroism that overshadows the duty of the police to protect. And you could see this very explicitly in the kinds of language that this cop uses about himself on his website. And it's there in popular culture. We're built of texts. We are built out of things we see, things we read, things we experience. And so for me, trying to understand what motivated that psychology in that person, in that human being, was key. And it's, and I think it is key to understand how we retrain the police. You know, because as I, you know, the line I read, I've had 8 hours of cultural diversity training and have been trained in racial profiling. That's on that guy's website. Clearly didn't help him, right? So I just, you know, that was my goal.
Other questions?
Yeah, just to touch on, I'm a third-year law student, and this summer I was working with a judge, and currently I'm working with a U.S. attorney, and the accountability that the U.S. attorney at, like, the Southern District, he's pre-Bahara, doesn't even really have that much power. The most he can do are these complaints and these, like, press conferences, and he really works at police corruption, and they call him, like, the Sheriff of Wall Street, and it's interesting that, you know, you talked about the legal transcripts, because working there and, you know, being a law student, also being a black woman, having to, like, compartmentalize a lot what I do and what I'm studying and just how I live my life. But what I constantly see with police officers and for lawyers, whether you're defense or whether you work for the city or the government, is that there's this no snitching culture. And that's the biggest problem. Like, no one's really held accountable of that. And, you know, you were talking about, like, what we could do as citizens and what people could do who work in these fields, and I feel like it's so systematic at this point that little things that Preet Bharara does is amazing, because at least these people are, you know, held accountable in this way that's very public. And unfortunately, the way the system works currently is that if people continue to have this no snitching kind of mentality, no one's gonna really be held accountable. And I've seen indictments, and I've seen, you know, juries with people who seem great, like grand juries, people who seem like hardworking, people who understand these cases or how to understand how to, you know, be a proper jury, they still have this like reasonable logic for police officers, no matter how ludicrous the cases are and how obvious that they should be indicted. There's always this logic, reasonable logic just held for police officers in this specific way that's, you know, really damaging. And I say that just to say that I think that for the most part, we're just like in this transitionary period. You know, I think we're all trying to figure out what to do next or like what's our responsibility. And we're learning these like particular language to discuss things and we're using them in our social media and with each other. But I think I think everything's gonna have to change at this point. And I think we're all noticing that, just the way that people, you know, with Black Lives Matter, even that existing now in the same way. So I'm just saying that I'll say that your pieces I found just very, very, very smart and just a very interesting way of looking at it. You know, when I saw that video on YouTube, you know, or on Twitter, you know, I was distraught because it was just really painful for me to see that. But to use the transcript and the fiction pieces that you wrote, I just found that was like perfect. Because I think that a lot of the times people don't really see, they really separate themselves. They may feel bad in a certain way, but humanizing people in that way through fiction is always important, through art. Like, you know, with your video, I just found it really funny and like really interesting, but at the same time, those images of Reepa just back and forth, just feeling a certain way. I was like, that's kind of how I feel as a Black woman in relation to Black men being, you know, murdered daily in a certain way. I kind of feel like
and women, definitely.
But I'm just saying the role that us as Black women kind of have, we're always the protector, but we're distraught, and we're always just like, we actually feel helpless a lot of the times because, but we're also these protectors, you know? So I just wanted to say all that to say that I really digged it, and thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for your work that you're doing.
Other questions? There are two in the back.
Thank you both for your work. I was just curious if you had ever come across while sort of on YouTube and also experiencing some of these videos. I think it was earlier in this year, maybe, different police departments, as part of sort of their community relations efforts, were, I think, was putting out a video centered around like the Running Man dance and almost this surreality of kind of this other side, other art, or I don't know quite what to call it, but sort of this reality of police departments participating in this media ecosystem, and what you thought about that, whether that kind of affected your thought processes at all.
So participating in what system?
The social media ecosystem.
Yeah.
You know, producing music videos and things like that.
Oh.
There's like this one police officer, I think, who he calls it community policing. He like videos himself talking about the Black kids and playing around with them trying to fix his image or something. Yeah.
I mean, the video that I saw that like was this, like it was a bunch of cops stopping people and then like giving them like cake or some shit.
Ice cream.
And like the people are terrified.
Right.
And you're just like, this is not nice. This is not, it's like, and I feel like it's so disingenuous to be like, oh, you thought that you were being stopped by a cop and might die today, but instead you get ice cream. It felt horrible to me. I don't know. I mean, the social media presence of this cop, when I was doing research for the story, all I saw were screenshots of like that people had posted from his Facebook page, and one of them was like him at a Halloween party wearing a sombrero, and I just was like, yeah. But I don't know if I have any kind of feelings about it. I think that they're I think they, like, cops have a right, and, like, it's, you know, everyone's like, not all cops, and it's like, yeah, but it's like, there is a systemic problem, so to kind of try to brush up or polish up the reputation of the police, that's not going to unseat the deep fear that Black people have every time they're stopped by a police officer.
I loved the ice cream video for that reason, because I'd seen the like the Tommy off, it kept popping up on my feed, and it was just like this frustrating thing. I couldn't quite articulate why. And then to see the people being stopped over and being like, I'm going to die, you know, something's going to happen, or I'm going to be charged, or something's going to happen today. And just that terror on their faces before the like publicity stunt happened was everything. And I think that there's a lot of comfort in being able to be like, oh, all we need is a PR campaign and it's gonna be fixed. Like people see us as great and we just need this like one, our social media account is gonna fix all our issues. I really feel like, that to me is very telling as to like, cause I feel like the discourse on that, on let's say like, I don't wanna say the black side, but I feel like there's a lot of discourse on like, proving humanity, like just trying to come up with language to say we're human, and also the resistance and resilience of existing, and like all like the fact that you know, like on the other side, that is the language and that is the task at hand, and that task is so multiplicitous and continues to be necessary. And then on the other side, it's like if we have this PR campaign, things will be solved. Not to say it, not to draw a clean line, but yeah.
Hey, thank you both so very much for sharing your work and sharing the thoughts behind the work. Nawali, I hear you talk about this like very in-depth sounding research that you did on this police officer when you were writing this story. And then as someone who's done social science research and had to transcribe tons of stuff, I can only imagine how long it took you to transcribe and how many times it took you to watch that video to transcribe what is a very complex series of verbal interactions. And I'd love to hear a little bit about how you lived that experience of not just being a witness once or twice, but being a witness repeatedly and delving into, at the same time, the psyche of this police officer.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's in some ways actually. To be perfectly honest, I think applying an analytic, almost kind of clinical research brain to it allowed me to compartmentalize it. So by the time I was in the process of doing that research and writing that transcript, I was no longer experiencing that violence, and especially I sort of reenacted or pre-enacted what we did tonight, where I wouldn't be watching it, I would just have it be playing while I typed, so I didn't have to see it, and it is it's still very disturbing, but it's slightly different to not see that little girl. When I first decided I wanted to write this story, I showed the video to my mother and I showed the video to my sister because they hadn't seen it yet. And I was, so rewatching it with them was much more disturbing and painful for me. And I don't know, it's very, I guess I must identify with her. Like when I watch that, I have to. And you know, in trying to understand like why I feel so much felt so much when I watched it. There's so much fear there and there's so much grief there. And like the fact that she just keeps asking for her mother and that doesn't trigger anything in him is so, that was one of the, I think that was the hardest thing for me. He to me, like, and it's unfortunate, but it's like, he's a villain and he's a cipher. And I did not, it was easy for me to cartoonize him because I never felt empathy for him. More recently, you know, one of the things I learned was that he had responded to two suicide calls before going to this incident, and his lawyer presented that as a reason for him being distraught. And one of the suicide cases was a young girl young white woman on her roof, and he had talked her down. And the other one was a black man who had shot himself, and he had spent most of his time comforting the family. And it's very interesting because that gives you a much more complex understanding of who this person is. But at the same time, it's like I would have that information in my head, and then I would like watch the video again, and I'd be like, it's so hard to put this person together with this. And, you know, his Facebook feed would have like heroic stories of, and that just felt like so off that I ended up just deciding that the lawyer had told a good story, because it was just so hard for me to actually perceive him as human. And it took like two or three revisions for me to even give him a humanity, because he just seemed like just violence embodied to me for a really long time. So in that sense, like it never hurt my feelings to be inside him. It hurt my feelings much more to experience that video in the first place.
Question, I guess maybe more of a comment, and I was just thinking about how like quick your pieces were, and like just kind of comparing that to social media and how quick it is we see these videos, and we just the proliferation of them, so of seeing so many bodies die all the time, and how there's a kind of maybe like a numbness to it at the same time, and how we can also just see all these things continuously and just like scroll down through our walls or whatever. And so there was like a quickness as well to both your pieces. And I thought of your story as like a short story. And like I've always enjoyed the medium of short story because it condenses so much in like a very like profound way that you kind of get a really good sense of the story. So I guess maybe there's like a question of like, maybe a comment about like the time of, or the, was like a conscious decision for them to be quick or short? And also just jumping off your comment about the cop and that, like trying to not think in these binaries of like good and evil and how those things are so intertwined and like complex. Mm-hmm. And again, like the shortness of the story kind of, there's a way that like, it's hard to get into the complexity of that as well. Maybe you could like comment.
In terms of quickness, I think it makes sense that the pieces are short. Because I think if to talk about this like ongoingness or like repetition, I think for Everybody Dies, it was all emotional aspects of it are so clipped and so erased that all you had was the structure that was breaking itself to stay clean. And I think I have to think about, I'll think on that, on the question a little bit more, but I think that the quickness of it just represents that move away from telling maybe a story with like an emotional logic and where emotions have the space to grow and build and evolve and shift and change, and moving into this space, this structural space where it's sort of like everything's clipped and all we have is the repetition of the superstructure. But let me think on that one.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I have a similar answer in that because the goal of the piece was to create an emotional atmosphere or to try to recreate for the reader what I felt. The analytic, that the analysis or the unpacking of, or even the legalistic mold of figuring out exactly what happened and assigning blame. And I felt like not only would that cloud my attempt to get at the emotion, but it's also always there. That context is everywhere. That's all we do is read think pieces and read, you know, what Ta-Nehisi Coates has to say, and that's all we do is see the kind of complexity and the analysis. And so I wanted that to be stripped out of the story as much as possible, so that I could through style and through sound try to produce a feeling. Because like one of the things, like, you know, the first question pointed out that we were losing sight of like the human beings, but I felt like one of the like there's a focus on the human beings involved in these incidents, rightly so. But I think what's so compelling about Francis's piece, and one of the things I was trying to capture, is the way that it's all of these incidents affect us as people, not just the people who were involved, and that emotional burden that we carry, that kind of mourning that we feel, and so trying to replicate that emotion has a basis, and I think is important, and for me required a certain kind of speed and an excision of exposition, basically.
Yeah, I think it's also just, I think I agree with you. I think it's speaking to how we receive this information right now, that the sort of like overall view we had, like the every 28 hours thing, or this idea that like when everybody dies with the map, where it's like in this second, this is happening across the whole country at the same time, and the volume becomes so grand. But also this quickness is also a part of how the discourse evolves now, where like whenever there's an attack within 24 hours, or not even 24, there's like the think pieces that are like, but you're not talking about this thing that happened over there. And then the other one that comes that's like, you know, you can't, you know, shame us for mourning this place. And then it's like this discourse around the event, the violent event, is just so fast and so similar every time, I feel.
It's like a miasma at this point. It really just like surrounds all of these incidents.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think of these pieces and their quickness. But for me, like the first section, like there's a lot of sort of like stillness and like sort of like stretching out, or like it just seems like it's almost like a vanitas. Like there's, you know, there's not so much like temporal progression in a lot of the first section. It's sort of like everything's just like happening at once. And that seems like there's like a kind of like generosity there to the teenagers, that the sort of like the fun and the joy and the lightness that they're experiencing like will endure in some way, even though it is like so like tragically like temporary.
Yeah, I feel that way about the kids' faces in your piece. Like when the kid gets the answer wrong and he's like, oh. Yeah. It's like, there's such beauty there. Oh, that's my resistant. God. And that's what stays with me. I mean, obviously Ripa stays with me too, but it's less their deaths that stay with me and more those faces. How did you cast them?
Well, the Brooklyn Children's Theater, very good group. But that moment is very important for me as a director too, because I remember going in and what I had written, or what my co-writer and I had written, was that they would be terrified and they would be really scared, because of course these kids are going to their death, and to have these kids are like, we brought them onto the stage and this one girl just goes, oh, I get it, we died, we're coming in through the life, like they were just happy to be there and they were just like playing with each other. They created all these games with the size and everything. It was just, and like, I remember walking away from like our first like run through of trying to shoot it, being like, I'm never gonna get these kids to be scared. And then eventually it was like, no, like just for them to be there and be light was the resistance, right? Like that, the resistance to my form was awesome. Yeah. Yeah, so like that lightness, there's the line from yours where it's like, we're giggling like we're made of bubbles. And I love that. I'm misquoting it, but yeah, I love that.
Okay, that seems like it might be a good time to end tonight. Thank you all again for coming. Okay.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, guys.